Okay, good evening. Welcome to this Wisdom Live event. Thank you for coming. We're very happy to be here with Bikram Naleo this evening. And we're also happy to be back in the Divinity School. It's an amazing venue. And very glad to be hosting this event with the Buddhist Ministry Initiative. The program this evening is going to begin with a discussion, and then we'll have a 10-minute intermission, followed by a presentation by Bhikkhu Analio, and then end with a Q&A. Also, if you're watching on the live stream, you can submit questions that way. If you need to leave during the event, please do so kind of to the back and up this side aisle, because we don't want to walk in front of this camera. You can also buy Bhikkhu Analio's new book at the back of the room, and we have refreshments. Nice waving wisdom people ready to sell you his book. And we have some refreshments as well to enjoy at intermission. So I think that's it. So please do silence all devices and join me in welcoming Bhikkhu Analio, wisdom publisher and CEO Daniel Aitken, and professor of Buddhist studies at the Harvard Divinity School, Charles Hallisey.
So welcome to this Wisdom Live event. I wanted to thank Chris Burley and the Harvard team for making us welcome and putting on another fantastic event for us. And thank you all for coming. I was a bit apprehensive with the topic of rebirth. I was thinking if we do like Buddha's brain or Buddhism and science or Buddhism without belief, we'll fill the room. But I was wondering, rebirth, how many people are going to come to that? So it was so reassuring to see so many people at this event. And I think, or maybe you're all here because Venerable Analio is in the house.
I don't think so.
So thank you all for coming. We're, in a way, celebrating Bhikkhu Analio's new book, Rebirth. Rebirth in Early Buddhism and Current Research. So I thought I'd start off the conversation. Is my mic okay? Yeah. I thought I'd start off the conversation with asking, how did this book come about?
Well, yes, a little bit funny for me to write a book on a topic that I'm actually not really interested in. When I was living in Sri Lanka and reading up on Buddhist doctrine, I was reading everything except for rebirth, because I thought, what's there to talk about? So what happened is that a friend of mine asked me if I could say something on this idea that seems to be fairly prevalent in certain Western circles, and sometimes even in Asia, that the Buddha didn't teach rebirth. And so that is something that, because early Buddhism, the comparative study of the source of early Buddhism is my specialist area, and this is something I can talk about with confidence, is very clearly that to the extent that we can reconstruct what the Buddha said through the textual sources, rebirth is an integral part of early Buddhist teachings. But that was just going to be an article. But while I was writing that article, I was looking at some of the recordings. This is a friend of mine from Sri Lanka who, according to his memory, as a small child, was able to chant all this Pali material. When I looked at the recordings and I started to compare them with the existing editions, I found that they don't match. I thought, wow, that's something. That's quite something. And this is more than just an article. And so in order to understand that whole issue, I had to look at other reports of children who remember something that they believe is from a past life, and then also at other sort of evidence for rebirth. And I also wanted to look at that whole debate around rebirth, the history of that debate, and also the motivations and why it is so heated. And that it ended up in having four chapters. So the first chapter is the early Buddhist doctrine of rebirth. The second chapter on this debate from ancient India to modern times. The third chapter on all the different evidence that has been adduced in support of rebirth. And then the fourth chapter is this particular case study. And it is, I think, the first solid case study of what we call xenoglossy, the ability to speak a language that, to all appearances, somebody has not learned.
So let's talk a little bit more about this ability to talk, to speak in a language that you haven't, it seems like that boy hadn't learned. He was chanting Pali sutras, is that right?
Yeah.
And then what made this case so compelling for you?
Well, first of all, I mean, I know him personally for quite a long time. And so this is, of course, not evidence. This is just a personal impression. I know that he's a very honest person. So when he says, I remember having learned this in the past, his memory might be wrong, but he's speaking the truth. And then his way of chanting is very different from the way usually in Sri Lanka Pali is chanted. Pali traditional chanting, and the monks here in the assembly will know, is in Sri Lanka is very kind of, it's not melodious at all. And sometimes it's very fast. You will hear like several monks chanting together, and one monk, if he has to take breath, another monk will continue. So it's something very continuous. This chanting is totally different. It's very melodious, and he always takes breaks. It's very meditative. And so this already fascinated me at that time. In fact, when I was doing my research on Satipatthana, I learned chanting from him, so that in addition to the academic research, I would also have a traditional approach to the discourse. But what really struck me is that the way he chants, you know, if you teach somebody to chant, you have to have an original. You have to have a written original. And if we are there in Sri Lanka and you get this child to chant, you would have to use PTS edition or the Sri Lankan edition. You would have to use one of these editions. But none of these editions fits what he chants. And on top of that, he makes errors which make no sense. He makes this error that in the Mahanidana Sutta there's a whole chunk that is completely missing. Now, because of my research on oral recitation, I know how these things can happen. You recite something, and actually you should be putting that whole other thing in between. Nothing happened, everything is fine. You should be putting that whole other thing in between and then continue, but you drop it and move on to the next. But this kind of loss of text is known in academic circle only since this century. So anybody trying to make this boy chant in the 80s or 90s in Sri Lanka, they would never have had the idea of saying, let us cut out this whole chunk to make it sound original. And then I think the most powerful thing is in two suttas, in one sutta where he actually puts in the brain in a list of anatomical parts. And we know that the brain eventually became part of that list, but not in the suttas. And the other one even stronger, and this is the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. In fact, the cover image is a representation of the Buddha giving, this is the first discourse according to tradition spoken by the Buddha, the discourse on setting in wheel, the setting in motion the wheel of Dharma. When the Buddha has given that first discourse, there is this acclaim, the celestial acclaim, all the different devas. Yes, yes, wonderful, the Buddha has done it. And in his chanting, there's a whole subclasses of devas that do this, which we get in no edition. And nobody would have the idea of putting that in. So that makes me feel confident of saying that this is a genuine case of xenoglossy, of recitative xenoglossy. We have two types. One is, like I'm now talking, the ability to actually talk freely. The other one, recitative, is just you are able to recite something, but you don't necessarily understand it. You're not necessarily able to communicate, so it's that type.
How old was the boy when he was chanting?
Well, according to his own recollection, he started very, very early at 3 and 4 years of age. If you listen to the chantings, he's already a little bit older. He must be about 6 or 7. And that fits the research done by Stevenson on children who believe that they remember past lives. Usually they start remembering at a very, very early age. When they get to 6, 7, or 8, they start forgetting things.
So we have a boy who's about 3 years old, and then he's chanting in a unique fashion.
In a very unique fashion, yeah.
He doesn't understand what he's chanting.
He doesn't understand what he's chanting.
But he's chanting sections of a text that is not extant today. Is that right?
No, the texts are extant today. I am talking about variant readings, and maybe I should explain that a little bit more. Maybe Charles likes to say something on that?
It's a very unusual example. There's other Stevenson's like collected other examples of children who are kind of chanting what they say is Pali or Tibetan, but people who know the Pali say, no, it's just gibberish. It's sounds that sound like Pali, but they're not. In this case, Venerable Anaglio is able to show, well, these are texts that are known in a variety of printed editions, variety of traditions, but they are variants of what we know. And so it's not something that is made up, but it seems to be an independent transmission of what we know from other transmissions. And so one of the really striking and unusual things is, you know, you have a whole variety of instances of xenoglossia, one where in rural Sri Lanka, a boy growing up with a very pious Buddhist family is chanting Arabic, like Muslim prayers, in an area where Muslims are not. And you say, well, how did that happen? But all of these are by hearsay. You know, that people are saying, oh, we heard the boy doing this and so on. This is a case where it's been recorded, and then the recording can be compared to other editions. And what Venerable Anaglio does is as if you were editing a separate transmission of manuscripts. Mm-hmm. It's a different witness, and you're editing it in the way that you would edit as if we found manuscripts in any other part of the world. And it's a unique kind of example that's been done. I've never seen anything like it. And you just say, oh, this is something that you have to pay attention to. Yeah. You know, exactly how the child is able to recite so much and so accurately. What other explanation besides something like rebirth? There's not any that is ready at hand. But you just say, oh, we have the textual evidence here that is just a remarkable document. I'll just say that if you didn't read the earlier sections, you would just see it as if you were just editing it, like yeah. Northern Thai manuscripts or yeah, something. Yeah, yeah. We found a new library, and we're just comparing it and saying, oh, this is how this version came about. And you wouldn't have any ideas of, oh, this is some kind of recollection of things learned in a previous life.
Yeah.
How do you think you might explain that if you didn't resort to rebirth?
It's above my pay scale. this is one of the things that's most remarkable is that the other cases, they can be disputed in terms of the transmission. That, that people said, oh, the child can remember this, and there's enough kind of leeway in the place where you could say, well, maybe, maybe not. This is like a case that you would just say, this is something that needs to be looked at very carefully. And then the other thing that I would say, a big surprise for me was the way that you looked at the way that people have memories that, in near-death experiences, that memory being tied only to the brain. We could say, we have enough examples of that in medical research. So it's just like, there's so much we don't know about what's going on here.
Yeah, and for me also, there are like personal things that happen in the exchange with him. For example, there's one story which earlier I thought, but I then didn't put it into the book. So I was reciting the Satipatthana Sutta, and there's one part where there's instruction on practicing mindfulness with different bodily behaviors. And so there's one part that says saminjiti pasarite, which means like stretching and bending the arm. And so we were reciting it together, and then he asked me, Bhante, what does this mean? Because every time I recite this part, I feel like giggling. And I said, there's nothing to giggle. It's just arm moving like this. What is there to laugh about? And he said, oh. And he was kind of like disappointed, but that was it. And it was years later that I found there is a story about this in the commentaries. And the story is, and now we're making a little bit fun of monks, if I'm allowed to do that. So there are monks and nuns sitting listening to a Dharma discourse. And the monk should be aware of what he does when he stretches or bends his arm, but he's not. So he stretches his arm, and he touches a nun. And he touches her on the breast. He pulls it back, and she pulls it back. You can imagine the rest of the story. And you can imagine why a monk who recites that part would feel giggling.
So when you ask the boy, you know, what's his explanation for how he can recite in a language he's never learned and feels emotions in regards to the chanting that he can't understand, what's his explanation?
Well, you know, I never asked him that question because I said I wasn't interested in rebirth. And he had gotten all this attention from others because of rebirth, and our whole relationship was like, yeah, yeah, that rebirth stuff, we don't. We are just friends, we want to chant, you know. We were interested in the Pali and the Dhamma. And our whole relationship was basically based on putting that excitement about rebirth to the side and going to the things that we are really interested in, the teachings, the meditation practice. So we never really discussed that much.
Can I just add what I think is an important detail of the joke? Because what that he says, oh, I felt like giggling, and there's a story that's in the commentaries. What it's indicating is some presence of a very learned monk, not just someone, so that what's being carried is not only the Xenoglossia, but the framework of the study and the understanding of the tacit knowledge go around it, that's there as well, in the way that you know, memories themselves work.
Yeah, but he didn't know that story anymore.
No, but the idea
but
that...
But there was still this kind of like, when you chant, saminjite pasarite, you go a little bit like giggling, and then you continue chanting, you know?
Right. This is a topic of scholarly research of monastic humor. That there's many PhD studies that can be done on the humor that's to be found in monastic studies. Can I just say one other thing, in terms of the cases of the reincarnation type, it's very important in all of the cases that the children are very young. And that's because very young children are not really capable of lying, that they don't know how to deceive other people. And it's humorous when you see them starting to learn how to try. I had a friend once who, her son was 4, and they wanted to go to a city pool. And you had to be 5 to go into the pool. And she told her son, you know, when you get there, they'll ask you how old you are. And if you want to go swimming, say that you're 5. I'm not recommending this as parenting. And so when he got there, the gatekeeper said, how old are you? And he said, I'm 4, except when I want to go swimming, and then I'm 5. And so that there's like a natural honesty to very small children. And they're not able to construct the kind of the falsehood that the rest of us are very good at. But that's the significance of the children having these memories.
And it seems that the memories fade as they grow older. Is there an explanation for why that happens? Does the RAM get filled with new memories?
I think we have the suggestion that that is so, and I think it also makes in a way sense. In fact, for some of these children, this is now Stevenson cases, they experience a lot of conflict. They would actually like to be able to let go of that past identity, and for my friend that was definitely so. He found it really like that attention and the pressure he was going, and that he was not being allowed to be a child at his age, but it was always like, oh, he's the rebirth case, wow. This is just very difficult for them to handle. And there's also an observation by Stevenson based on a survey of many cases, that usually those who do remember in childhood have died a violent death. So his explanation is that people who die normally, kind of with their life more or less complete, then the probability that these memories carry over to the next life is not so strong, because in a way you have finished your business, if I may say so. But if you die a violent death and things are like unfinished, you find yourself in the new situation, then all these past things still come up and you have to really transition between the two. But I think many of them are actually happy when they can forget about it. But that is again assuming that this is really about rebirth, and I want to be clear that I think the case I'm establishing a case of Xenoglossy. I also agree with Charles that it is probable that rebirth is the explanation, but I'm not marketing it as the proof of rebirth. I want to be very clear on that. And the whole purpose of that book is to open dialogue and not to say, no, I've shown you, Buddha is right.
Just to set for people who don't know, Stevenson was a professor at the University of Virginia, in the medical school?
Yeah, and he dedicated his whole life to researching cases, what he calls cases of the reincarnation type. He was around the world and trying to get records of small children who seem to remember a previous life and who are able to give information that in some way or another can be verified. And he's written lots of books. I mean, this is amazing. It's like about this much of books on the cases, and then these two big volumes where he also studies like birth defects and similar things, where somebody like has an accident and then in the next life they still have some repercussions of that and similar type. But his research has not been taken very seriously.
I think the difficult thing about rebirth is that for most of us, it's not directly observable, right? And that's not to say it's fictitious. Just because we can't perceive something doesn't mean it's not there. And we have ways of knowing things that are out of reach of our senses. So we can use reason. We can rely on testimony. And so I'm wondering if you think that rebirth, we can know rebirth through reason, or in the early Buddhist tradition, is reason a way to know rebirth, or do we need to rely on the testimony of others until we directly perceive it ourselves?
What would you say to that?
I think that ideas about rebirth are like my ideas that I am an individual. The fact that I'm an individual, I can't observe. I can't begin with an idea. How do I prove to myself that I'm an individual? I begin with a way of looking at things, and then it's confirmed by things that happen to me. But someone observing me, say, you're not an individual at all. You speak the same language as everyone else. You dress like everyone else. You walk down the street and you're immediately identifiable as an American. So that there's all kinds of things. You say, there's not a shred of individuality to you. And you say, but I experience myself as an individual. And you say, I have a way of organizing the information in the world. For me, I think that rebirth is an idea that is a way of organizing information in the world, in which then you start to find confirmation of it all the time. And then when you hear stories of the reincarnation type and of children, it's an added kind of thing. But you couldn't reason, I don't think you could reason yourself to the idea of saying, I'm an individual. You know, Descartes could say, I think, therefore I am, but that's pretty slim evidence here. And so you say, because we're not beginning with the idea, we're looking for some way, convince me. But if you begin with the idea, you just find confirmation of it. In the same way that you would say, I endlessly find confirmation of the fact that I'm an individual, even though there's no evidence for it.
Yeah, I resonate very much with what Charles said. And from
can I just interrupt you? And just say, when he said he resonates with me, he was proving that I'm not an individual.
Who is that?
Missed it. No, what I found so fascinating when I started to read the different research on it, how much people are actually influenced by what we call my side bias or confirmation bias in cognitive psychology, and how exactly the same evidence is led as proving totally opposing points. So I'm not really interested in this whole direction of can we prove, can we reason our way to rebirth. I just don't really see the point. I think we just have certain informations and we look at the information, then build our own view about what Charles said as an individual. Very much resonates with me.
So Dharmakirti was famous for making a proof for future lives. And so we don't find that in early Buddhism. Is that what you're saying? We don't find similar proofs for...
Well, this type of approach for the gaining of knowledge is not recognized as a fully valid source of knowledge in early Buddhist thought, because this is tukkha reasoning, and something can be well reasoned and still be wrong. Something can be not well reasoned to be right. So it's more, the emphasis is more on the direct experience.
So then this.
So I'm not saying something against Dhammakirti, of course.
Of course not.
I'm just saying that the early Buddhist epistemology differs from later traditions. And so the premise that you can reason to something and thereby prove it, I think from an early Buddhist viewpoint, would probably not be considered as a real proof that something is indeed like that.
What about Theravada Buddhism? Do they have like an anumana pramana, inferential valid cognition?
I don't think that in the Theravada tradition, as far as I know, that this kind of pramana tradition developed to the same level of energy and sophistication and nuance that's happened in the pramana tradition with Dignaga and Dharmakirti. But I would just say generally, historically, you're always going to have some individuals, many of whom have gravitated to places like Harvard University, that they're looking for other ways of confirming, kind of logically proving something, that other people don't feel any need to do that. And so then to look at Dharmakirti and generalize from him towards a Buddhist world at his time, you'd probably say, well, he was probably really quite unusual. That most people didn't feel the need for it. And most people probably didn't even have to think about, is this a form of valid knowledge or not? So
that brings me to another idea that this idea of rebirth was prevalent at the time of the Buddha and in ancient India. And some people have suggested that the Buddha just took for granted rebirth, and that and so he taught it because it was a prevalent idea at his time, and therefore we don't have to take it so seriously today. What do you think of that sort of line of reasoning?
Well, what I try to show in my book is that, first of all, there were quite a number of people in ancient India who did not believe in rebirth, so it was not just an universally accepted doctrine. But the idea of rebirth is really intimately woven into the very structure of early Buddhist thought. It is knowledge that, according to the discourses, was gained by the Buddha in the night of his awakening, that he recollected his own past lives and that he saw the rising and disappearance of others. And things like the four levels of awakening recognized in early Buddhist thought are all intimately related with how much more of rebirth or freedom of rebirth. So I think that for that whole structure to stand, and according to tradition being attributed to the Buddha's own insight, that this position is really not convincing. I don't think it is really tenable if we do a thorough study of the textual sources for early Buddhism.
I would add to it that the fact that the statement, I love you, is a very common expression in English, that take that as evidence that when I say I love you to my wife is evidence that I'm not serious or meaning it. I'm just accepting what's in the general culture. That would be an error. And so the idea that, you know, oh, just because other people were talking about it, it wasn't serious or part of what he was trying to think through, I just think that's a very, very kind of flawed but common argument. Yeah. And academic Buddhist studies is very guilty of that kind of analysis.
Yeah, I like to add to this, actually, Charles, what Charles said, that if we look at the suttas again, I mean, we have no firm evidence for the historical Buddha as a living person.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the Buddha as he emerges from the earliest strata of text at our disposition. So the kind of personality that emerges there is somebody who has a very independent thinking, and he's very well able to dismiss thoughts and ideas that do not accord with his understanding. So to believe that he just took over something that actually he knew rebirth is just nonsense, but let's take it on just so that my doctrine sells better, it really doesn't fit the way he emerges in the early discourses.
I think the argument's a little inconsistent anyway, because it comes from a basis of, you know, the rational Buddha would not have really accepted rebirth if it wasn't prevalent in his time. Well, the rational Buddha then would have analyzed to see if that made sense for him. So it's a little bit of an inconsistent argument.
Yeah, but this is a basic tendency in Western Buddhism that has its roots in Protestant Buddhism in past colonial history, and is based on the universalization of subjectivity. I like this, therefore this must be what the Buddha taught. But that is not really a valid way of determining what the Buddha taught.
So if we agree that the Buddha taught, you know, past lives, that he could, you know, he said that he could see you know, his past lives, and that he could see other people's future lives. And he said that. So is that ability something that's a side effect of spiritual progress, or is that something that's necessary for spiritual progress in early Buddhism?
Well, I don't think he could see into the future. I think he could just see at that time somebody passing away, being reborn in such and such circumstance. So this is a present moment knowledge. The idea of having definite knowledge about the future is not really, according to my understanding, an integral part of early Buddhist thought. We have it in the Chakravati, or sometimes called Chakravati Siyanara Sutta, with this Maitreya episode, the future Buddha. But I've been able to show through comparative study that this is a later element in that discourse. So according to early Buddhist thought, you cannot predict something with absolute certainty for the more distant future. You can only say right now the conditions are such that such and such thing is probably going to happen. But the suttas show us that there were a number of monks and nuns developing the Te Vidya, the three knowledges, which is recollection of one's own past life, the divine eye, it is called, the ability to see beings right now passing away, being reborn, and the destruction of the influxes, which is full awakening. But others only realized that last one. So as far as I can see, the rebirth doctrine, as much as it is an integral part of early Buddhist thought, is not an indispensable necessity for somebody to walk all the way to full awakening. And this maybe ties in also with the question of how in the West somebody should approach the topic of rebirth, because of course there is the problem that much of science is based on the paradigmatic assumption that the whole of the mind is a product of the brain. And so even though that assumption itself has never been really proven, all research done based on that paradigm seems to confirm that. And so as a rational Westerner, familiar with scientific thought, am I now being asked to believe something that I find unbelievable just so that I can be a practicing Buddhist? And there I think we can make a distinction between different types of right and wrong view. In the early Buddhist scheme, the path to liberation involves the Noble Eightfold Path, and the first factor is right view. So there is right view simply in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And this does not imply that one has to accept rebirth as a belief. So with that much, one can do the practice. It would just be wise to say, look, I don't know about rebirth, I don't believe it, but I'm also not totally sure it cannot be. It's just something I don't know, I'm not concerned about. And that is perfectly fine.
I would just only add to that, Venerable Anaglio mentions a number of very prominent contemporary Thai monks who have said, you know, rebirth is not necessary to the overall system of thought of the Buddha. And my own sense is that we can say, oh, this is a product of their historical conditions and their times. I'm also willing to be open to that in the past, there may have been quite a number of individuals who were as serious and readers and thinkers and meditators about Buddhist life and the Buddhist thought, that they also came to similar kinds of conclusions, but just didn't feel any need to try to make a case to disprove something. They would just say, you know, it's not necessary for what I is important for me in my own life. I told both of you before we started about someone in Sri Lanka, Mahinda Paliwana, a very, you know, brilliant professor in Sri Lanka. And I once asked him, do you believe in rebirth? And he thought carefully and said, then said to me, there's nothing in my life that I needed to explain. And so then what he was doing, pretty much what Venerable Anaglio just was saying, is that there's lots of things that people tell me about superstrings, and I don't have to think too much about it in terms of what is important to me. And so you could say there's all kinds of areas of Buddhist thought that people are not, that they have to pay attention to.
So basically in early Buddhism, the advice is that, not that you have to believe in rebirth, but that it's best not to outright reject it. Is that what you were saying?
Well, there's no explicit advice of that type, but the formulation of wrong view is, among others, also the rejection of rebirth. And it's the rejection of responsibility towards one's parents, the rejection of the law of karma. So we might hold an agnostic position, but if we outrightly reject it, then at least in the frame of early Buddhist thought, I think we would be into trouble.
So let's say that we don't believe in rebirth. Then what is the goal of Buddhism?
Well, I am not sure if we can talk of Buddhism in this kind of like the goal of Buddhism, one goal. I mean, even in the early suttas, we find people with quite different interests and quite different inclinations. And there's the Buddha gives the whole discourse, the long discourse, the Sigalovada Sutta, just to somebody to show him how to improve his relationships with family and workers. There's nothing about Nibbana in there. So I think Buddhism has the realization of awakening as its focal core point. But from that, there's just a lot of variety, and you can accommodate all kinds of different people as long as they are in some way willing to accept that there's a distinction between ethical, wholesome, and unwholesome behavior, and that it's better to have wholesome behavior, and maybe open to looking at the mind.
So if there's no such thing as future lives, why should I be good from a Buddhist perspective? In that context?
Because it's painful if you harm others right here and now for yourself and others.
So karma holds when there's no future lives? Karma would hold in this life then?
Well, my karma of being able to speak here in English is the fruition of the fact that 3 decades ago I went to the UK and learned English. That's a very clear fact of karma. I was not born with the English language. But I went to the UK, I studied, and now I can communicate in English. So I don't need a future life or a past life for this karma and its result.
What about the last thing you do in this life?
The last thing I shall do in this life will be meditation. And that actually brings us to what I think is much more important, which is facing our mortality. And I have found in Sri Lanka that people who really live in rebirth are still afraid of death. And this is also why I'm not so concerned about rebirth. I'm really concerned about death. I do death contemplation every day. I like to teach it. I encourage it. And I think this is the real issue. And maybe this is also what is a little bit at the background of the heatedness of the discussion, but it's not really being spoken about, our mortality. And we are all going to die. Not a single person in this hall or out on the internet is free from mortality. Whether we will be reborn after that or we will see at that time, but it's facing death, facing the fact that we will die. And what does that mean for our life? How do we want to die? What do we want to have done before we pass on? What in our life is really important and meaningful when we are facing death? And when we are with others who are dying, I think these are much more important questions. Everybody looks a little bit sad now.
How do you think about your own death? Does that inform your life today? Just a small question.
My mother told me I wasn't going to die. So I'm kind of in shock. I think that what Venerable Anālaya was saying is very, very important. Of, you know, the Buddha, like, reminder that death is certain, life is uncertain. And also, you know, I would like to combine with that Marx's saying that death is hard for the living. And once I accept that death is certain, life is uncertain, then I can attend to also that death is hard for the living with other people who are experiencing it at that time. And so the care for the grieving that happens, the sadness that happens, the suffering that can't be removed, it has to be kind of endured, and at its best it can be learned from. And so that reminder, you could say, oh, this is a very important thing. But I think Venerable Anālaya says, you know, what I would say is that Buddhism, even say Buddhism is not one simple thing. as such, it's a full-service religion. And mm-hmm. so it has to do a lot more than just tell people, oh, you're going to die. So the Mangala Sutta is one that is very important mm-hmm. for me, and it tells you about, you know, who, you know, having friends, taking care of your parents, taking care of your children, preaching the Dhamma, meditating. And you could just say, oh, that this is a vision of a collective life, of people doing different things, but what each person is doing is enabling other people to do good things as well. This is something also that the Mangala Sutta is not taken seriously by academic Buddhist studies, yeah. but I think it's one of the most important texts that we have.
So let's imagine there is such thing as rebirth. So in the Buddhist context of no self, then what continues from life to life? This is a common question. Maybe boring for you.
Well, there is maybe sometimes a misunderstanding of the doctrine of not self as meaning that there is nothing at all. And this is not the case. In fact, one of my favorite sayings is the voidness of emptiness is filled to the brim with causes and conditions. So the not-self doctrine is not saying there's nothing at all. It just says there is no permanent essence in things. Everything is just a combination of causes and conditions. And so once we have the causes and conditions, then we don't have a difficulty to explain that there is a continuity, even if part of that set, which is the bodily, the somatic part, is left behind. And in the Mahanidhana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, we get the impression that it is particularly vijnana consciousness that is seen as the continuity from one life to the next. And then consciousness is just a stream, a flow of being conscious.
So consciousness is just a stream or a flow? No, it's just the flow of consciousness is what accounts for rebirth, is what you're saying?
That is, when we look at the early Buddhist teachings, we don't get like a clearly formulated out package, but we get these spotlights in different discourses. And so this is what I think the Mahanidhana Sutta in particular implies. Because it speaks of a consciousness going from one life to another, being established in the mother's womb, and things like that. So it seems that consciousness is seen as the continuity from one life to another. But I mean, it's a continuity already during this life. For Anarya to be here and talking, there's no permanent essence of Anarya anywhere. It's just the continuity of bodily and mental processes held together by causes and conditions.
So, well, Anarya has a, I don't know if it's an image original to you, but I was really quite struck by it. He describes a river coming down a very like muddy hill, so it's filled with dirt and mud. Yeah. It enters into a lake or a still area, and in that all the silt drops down to the bottom, and then it flows out on the other side. And so we say, oh, the river is the same on both sides of the lake. We call it this by the same name. But the idea of what continues, it would not be the same thing at all.
So in effect, when the Buddha, when he's, you know, the day of his enlightenment, when he's saying, oh, that person thousands of years ago, that was me. It's in a way he's just saying, oh, that is part of the river and that is part of the river. Is that the analogy?
You have this phrase that's very useful to remember because the way the question is posed is that, is it the same or different? But the answer is that it's neither the same nor different. And so you can't say that it's the same, you can't say that it's different. And that seeing how both of those things are simultaneously true is the answer to the question that you're...
It seems, though, that something persists other than the stream of consciousness. There's a sense that was me, or I am this, right? Like, we don't have the same... The Buddha didn't look at his hand and see the atoms in his hand and say, oh, and probably he could look back and say, these atoms were, you know, in this star, and that star was me. So there's something about the continuation of consciousness rather than the continuation of matter that, you know, is connected with this sense of, that was me. What do you think?
I don't know if I want to identify the statement that I'm talking about myself as, that is me, as my consciousness. I'm aware, you know, simply I'm aware that I'm aging. I'm not aware of the process of aging. I don't have any direct awareness of it, but I'm aware that I'm aging, and I'm aware that my consciousness has aged also, that the way that I experience myself now is different than I experienced myself when I was 19. And the way that I said that is me when I was 19 is different than I would say that is me now. And so what I just have is this ready-at-hand statement, that is me, that I keep on using all the time for different circumstances. And it's misleading that I think, oh, there actually is a me, that all those statements I make would be that is me.
Absolutely. But it's always there. And it's this subjectivity that seems problematic for the physicalist to explain, in my mind. So let me shift gears. So it's not like the Buddhist didn't argue throughout time with materialists, right? So there were people in ancient India that were saying there's no such thing as a mind that continues from life to life. Actually, everything can be explained, and they didn't use like the language of physics and chemistry, but they did say everything can be explained by these four or five elements, right? Okay. So how did the Buddhists of those times respond to those arguments?
Well, we have a very long debate in the long discourse collection, the Payasi Sutta, where a materialist king discusses the topic of rebirth with a Buddhist monk. And this discourse is very interesting because we not only have several Chinese parables, we also have a Jaina version of the same discourse. So it was very popular among the Shramana culture in ancient India. And this king describes different experiments. Whether he did them or whether he invented them, we don't know, but like cutting up the body of a person to see whether there's something that remains, or killing somebody. These were like criminals he caught, and killing them and putting them into some kind of container and then boiling and seeing if something comes out. All kind of different experiments to show, look, you're talking about something in addition to what is material there, but that's rubbish, it doesn't work. And this monk gives a series of answers, always showing that this relying on what is only visible to the eyes is not sufficient to draw real conclusions. It's a very fascinating discourse.
Yeah, you describe some of them in the book, all these experiments they did.
There's a few
experiments. Quite horrific, some of them, boiling.
we don't know, because we have to keep in mind that this is a debate, and a debate in the ancient Indian and also in the Tibetan context is very much about winning the debate and not so much about a historical truthfulness. So if you can make a good point by inventing a very nice story, you win the debate, you won the debate, even the story doesn't need to be true. So we are not sure if this Payasi really killed all these people in these crucial ways, but they are just good arguments in a debate situation.
Winning the debate is very important in the Harvard context too.
But I hope your students will be more truthful than ancient Indians.
Can you make up stories?
That's how I teach.
Wow. We are public, you know that.
That's not me.
So I think we might finish the discussion with, could you tell us a little, I want to go back to the boy who was chanting the Pali, and I wanted to go, there's a story, he does tell a story, speaking of stories, of how he came to be able to chant the Pali, and he recalls a memory of being with Buddha Gosa. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
He remembered being brought up in a Brahmin family, and this is something I'm going to touch on later in my talk, also the ancient Brahmins in India, they had a very, very strong culture in memorization. From small childhood onwards, they were taught to memorize. And then he was converted to Buddhism, and he was one of the monks, according to his memory, who accompanied Buddha Gosa in his journey from India to Sri Lanka. And he was apparently a Digabhanaka, a reciter of the long discourse collection. And it is, I mean, if you think in terms of manuscript culture, and I have some of my friends here who work with manuscripts in the audience, nowadays, if I want to find a reference, I just go, and I have it in the digital, but if you want to know, like, wait a moment, that discourse number 17 in Majjhima Nikaya, and you have this whole stack of manuscripts and you have to like go through and search it. It's just so much easier if you have a recital score. Can you just recite and you go, ba, 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 ah, yeah, that's the one I was looking for. So it seems that Buddha Gosa had this kind of like memory monks, specializers in the different Nikayas who were coming with him. And this boy remembers to have been one of these monks.
Wow, quite a story. Well, I think we'll end the discussion there. Thank you so much. Thank you. What we're going to do now is we're going to have a 10-minute break. And then Bhikkhu Anālaya will come back and do a talk on some of his research. And then we're going to have a Q&A. So we'll have questions from the audience here and also questions from those online. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back shortly. Thank you.
So right now we're actually playing the chanting. For anyone who's curious, this is the Dhamma Ruan. I hope I'm saying that right. This is the boy chanting the Pali from his past lives. Yes, and we're going to crank it up.
Doing a sound check when I talk like this. Can you hear me? At the back, can you let me know if you can hear me? You can't hear me. Some can hear, you cannot? It's good? Good, here we go. Yeah, so I was asked to give a little bit of a personal history of my research. I've done a short presentation of this type at the IAPS conference in Toronto, and I was asked to do it a little bit more detail and also get it like recorded for others to be able to look at it. And so what I'm going to talk is a little bit about my personal life and how I came to be an academic and how I came to do all these publications. And basically, as a starting point, when I got ordained as a monk, I had no plan whatsoever to do anything academic. I had done a BA in, equivalent to a BA in history in Germany, but that was it. And this is just a picture from the early time of my monk's life. I really like to go to these romantic places to meditate. There's this waterfall there. And for my first time as a monk, I lived in a cave that was very beautiful, a cave on top of a mountain on three sides surrounded by the ocean. And there was just nothing, you know, you just meditate the whole day. There were a few snakes, a few cacti, and then you just go down, get your food, eat, and go back. And that was basically the way how I thought I would be living my life. Now, even though the settings were very romantic from the outside, what was happening in my mind was not always as romantic. I was practicing a lot of mindfulness meditation, but the central problem I had was anger. I'm an anger type. And so I was told that, yeah, if you're anger type, you should practice metta. And so I tried this metta meditation, usually translated as loving kindness. And it had just no effect whatsoever. I was like, And then I started to look at the suttas, the Pali suttas, the translation. And I found that what they describe about metta meditation is completely different from what we usually get when we get traditional teachings. The discourses speak simply of an arousing of this condition of metta and radiating it in all directions. Nothing about verbalizing and a friend and a neutral person and an enemy. And when I started to play with that, suddenly things started to work. Suddenly that metta was doing something, and suddenly this very, very angry Anarya was becoming only very angry and then only angry. There was a very clear diminishment. And this kind of made me realize the difference between early Buddhism and later tradition and realize the significance of really seeing things in the historical perspective. And that has been kind of setting the course of the rest of my life as a practitioner and as an academic. And so I was living in Sri Lanka and I was running a small meditation center on the outskirts of Kandy. And one day my meditation teacher, my Kalyana Mitra, Gopin Samaratna, he had invited me to come along to the university. He was giving a meditation class at the university. So I went along and there was this meditation class, and when it was over, and you can see he has a little bit of this cheekiness, and he was a little cheeky also. He was sitting there just with the professors and me, and suddenly they start talking about me doing a PhD at the university. And I was sitting there, Anarya, they're talking about you, PhD, on Satipatthana. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, Sri Lanka is a little different from the West. If you disagree, you don't just stand up and shout. You just sit there and hope you get a chance later on to move things in your directions. I was not at all happy about this whole idea. But I talked with Godwin afterwards, and it was very clear that he wanted me to do that. And I said, okay, on one condition, I spent half of my time meditating. So I started to get into the university and do all my research, but I would always divide the day. In the mornings, I would do my research, the whole afternoon, silent retreat. And working in that way, the maintaining of the meditation practice really informed my work. And eventually then this became published as a book. This is my first book publication. And this book has immediately become a bestseller. And it has been translated into 10 languages and another 6 translations are underway. And I think the success of my PhD thesis is due to 2 reasons, as far as I'm able to say. One is that it came out at a time when this whole mindfulness became a mainstream interest. So I really just caught on a fashion, and that draw a lot of attention to it. But I think the other reason is also this, and this is really central for my whole life, this combination of practice and study. And in a way, I'm indebted to my parents for that. My mother was a very intellectual type. My father, very practical, intuitive. And somehow I inherited these two, and my job is kind of to bring them together. And I think the book really draws on interest. It's actually somewhat dry, but it draws so much interest because I'm using the academic methodology to find out things that are of practical relevance. And I'm looking at it also from a practice perspective. Like I was saying before, I even memorized the Satipatthana Sutta just to have another approach to look at that discourse. And that memorization with actually that Sri Lankan boy, that Dhammaruan, made me realize part of what was important in the Satipatthana Sutta that I would never have understood just by the academic method. So after my PhD finished and published, I got involved with the Encyclopedia of Buddhism. The Encyclopedia of Buddhism was started in the 1950s as a government project in Sri Lanka. And by that time, because of the civil war with the Tamils, the government was no longer giving any funding. And the chief editor, a very sweet old gentleman, he really wanted to finish that encyclopedia project, but he had no funds and nobody to write. And because I had free time, I said, okay, just give me what you have. And I ended up writing 80 entries for the Encyclopedia of Buddhism. And some of these have been published in book form. This is just a selection of those entries that are of interest for meditators. After that, I decided to go back to Germany. My parents needed my help. They were transitioning from working to retirement. They needed my presence. It was quite challenging, actually. You know, living as a monk in Sri Lanka is so easy. Living as a monk in the West is quite difficult. I've had people shout at me. I've had one time people throw a bottle at me. Like, just, you look so different. And it really irritates people. They think you're a freak. You're very strange. But anyway, that was what I had decided to do. Again, a similar thing happened as with Godwin. My whole idea was I stay with the parents and just do meditation. But then some family friend got my mother into this idea that, why don't you ask him to do a habilitation? And again, I was like, why should I do more academic work? I've already done this PhD. But then the thing was, you see, my mother, and we were very close. My mother, she had done an MA and with top results at her university in economy. And everybody was expecting her to go on for PhD and habilitation, but she didn't, because my grandfather needed her. And so she, in a way, wanted me to do what she had not been able to do. And I felt like compelled to do that. And so what I did then is to say again, okay, and I do again the same thing of half-time meditation, half-time work. And this time I split it so that I would do the first half of the week just in silent retreat, the second half of the week do my work. And for the habilitation, I decided to get into the Chinese Agamas. I had become aware during the Satipatthana research of the importance of the Chinese parallels. So I went to Germany and I learned Chinese, I learned Tibetan, and I also had to really brush up on methodology, because the methodology taught in the West is really very efficient. So there was a lot of things for me to learn, but there was also one thing that I had actually missed out because of getting my academic education in Sri Lanka, and that was going to be of my great advantage. And that thing was this idea that there's no early Buddhism. There are no sources for early Buddhism, because the Pali discourses and the Pali commentaries should be allocated to the same time period. Therefore, we have no sources for early Buddhism. And it's just meaningless to discuss it. Even one professor told me I should not even use the word early Buddhism, because it would show me to be unscientific. Now, if I had received this idea in first or second semester at the university, I would probably have swallowed it as part of that whole body of knowledge that you just take over. But when I came across this idea, I'd already done a PhD research on Satipatthana. Very clear difference between sutta and commentary. I had done all this research for the encyclopedia. Again, very clear differences. So it was just like, I can't buy this. I don't believe it. So the idea for my habilitation then was, let me try to find out by myself what is really there in type of evidence and what is the value of that evidence. So I took up the whole of the Majjhima Nikaya. The Majjhima Nikaya is a collection of middle-long discourses that have about 152 discourses and between 300 and 400 parallels in Chinese, Tibetan, Sanskrit, a few in Gandhari, a few in Uyghur. And I decided to study this whole collection because I wanted to get a clear idea of what kind of material that is. I was advised not to do it. They say it's much too big and you can't catch all the details. And yeah, I'm very much in love with details and precision. But I felt this time I have to really take on a very big project because I want to understand the type of material that we are dealing with. And so I started working my way through the Majjhima Nikaya, one discourse after the other. When I came to Majjhima 86, that is the famous story of Angulimala, that murderer who became an arahant, I had a crisis. I just couldn't make sense of my findings. There were so many similarities and so many differences. How to put that together? Just no idea. So I stopped the whole thing, stepped back, and tried to come back and try to understand, what is this material I'm dealing with? What is its characteristic, and how can I put all the findings I have into a meaningful context? And in that darkness of confusion, if I may call it such, I was particularly inspired by the work by Oscar von Hinüber and Mark Allen on Buddhist oral tradition. That was the first light in my darkness. But I had to go all the way to the Department of Cognitive Psychology to ask for help, to understand the working mechanism of textual memory. And that really solved the situation. Let me just grab some water. You see, memory, when we haven't really read or studied it, we think it's a little bit like a tape recorder. You just put it in and you switch on and it comes out again. It's not like that at all. Memory is very much an act of construction. Seeing all of you here, I'm not just taking that image into my mind, but I'm taking it together with associations, inference I'm drawing. And at a later time, when I want to recall it, it's not that just this whole image comes up. What comes up is just more like a general type of attitude. Based on that attitude, then I build it together. Oh, yeah, that was when I gave that talk at Harvard, blah, blah, blah. And so human memory is not as reliable as we would like it to be. In fact, police are very well aware of that, that they get this eyewitnesses of a particular accident or thing that happened, and they tell so much different stories. And they're not lying. This is their memory. And particularly interesting for my topic was one research done on textual memory. They used instructions for Microsoft Word. And they had three types of people. One, very professional, using Word every day. Another group, they had some idea of Word. Another group, no idea whatsoever. And they were given an instruction, asked to remember it. And later they were asked to identify which words were in that instruction to see how exactly they could remember that instruction. Which of these two, these three groups, do you think came on top? The beginners, those who didn't know. So you have already read the research. I thought I had this big thing to pull out of my face. I was really stunned by that. It's the beginners. Those who had no idea, because they were not able to draw inferences. They had only that surface meaning of the text, the words that didn't have any meaning for them, and so they remembered them with precision. And this particular research explains the strength of the Vedic oral transmission. In fact, if we want to understand Buddhist oral transmission, we have to stay in the same cultural context. There's sometimes a tendency to draw on research on Yugoslavian bards, the Peri and Lord model, and I think this is really a category mistake. We shouldn't use completely different text, a bard singing in a bar, and then in Yugoslavia to try to understand religious oral transmission of Buddhism in ancient India. We have to look at the same context. And so in ancient India, we have the precedent of the Vedic reciters. And the Vedic reciters, and I briefly said that before when we were talking about Dhammaruan, they start at a very small age, 5-6 years. And they were learning to recite texts that they did not understand. And they were only taught the meaning many, many years later. And now we know why. Because by not understanding what they were memorizing, they were training in precision of textual memory. And that is what enabled the Vedic reciters to pass on the Vedas for centuries and centuries with an incredible degree of precision. But the Buddhist monastics were not all Brahmins. And people, sometimes children became monastics, but sometimes at an adult age. So the Buddhists did not have this skilled in precise textual memorization. And that explains why we have so much variations. And also, there's a commentary tradition going along with the text. We had that story earlier about that Saminjike Pasari, the kind of thing. And so, just as when I try to remember something, I draw inferences, and later I don't really know, was that really there, or was that my inference? In the same way, if you have a story, or some text, or some explanation, you have a commentary, you put them into the mind. When you take them out, you're not longer so sure what was the origin, what was the commentary. And this is a way for later ideas to move into the text during oral transmission. So all these understandings of oral transmission then really helped me to make sense of my findings. And yeah, the habilitation completed. It was published in 2 volumes. I am not entirely happy with this publication, I have to say, because simply because of the breadth of material I work through, it doesn't have the type of precision I would like to have. It's simply impossible when you compare 150 Pali discourses with 300 to 400 Pali to have the same type of precision like when somebody edits one discourse, looks at the Chinese and the other Palis, there's a lot of more precision in there. So the main body of this book, two books, is basically meant as a starting point for other academics to go deeper. But what is important is the overall vision of the material I gained and what I say in the introduction and the conclusion. So in a way, I consider these two volumes as, I call it a 1,000-page footnote to one single statement. That was what I tried to find out, and that is what I've been able to prove, I think. This is genuine products of oral transmission. We have to take these sources seriously. Now, in the course of studying the Majjhima Nikaya, I made so much other findings. And I had no time to follow them up, so I had this whole long list with different notes and this and this and this. So after completing the habilitation, then I started to work through all these notes and keep publishing. And just pouring out one article after the other, because I had all the material already there. And also, in a way, the meditation again helped me, because somehow during the busy period of the week, I do all this research, and then I go to meditate, and I don't think about what I did, but somehow the mind is subconsciously processing things. When I come out of the meditation, I just have these very clear ideas, and I write an article like this in a so-called flow experience. And so in the 15 years since the publication of my PhD, I have produced over 300 academic publications. This is just far too much. Yeah, I know, I apologize for that. And Charles Müller, he has an online database for the different publications in Buddhist studies, and he's allowed me to use this picture. It just gives you an idea of how heavy I am on all my poor colleagues, just publishing, publishing, publishing. But I promise it's over now. I finished all of that. And I put all these articles into volumes with collected papers. So these are my collected papers, all of them based in one way or another on findings I made in the course of my habilitation. And I've organized them according to the four Chinese agamas, the Dirga Agama, Madhyama Agama, Samyukta Agama, and Ekottarika Agama. And again, there's many details in there. I'm more comfortable with these four than with the habilitation. And some of my findings are sometimes a little bit speculative, and we just have to wait what other scholars say about them. But I think taken together as a body, I can again say I can make one statement with firm confidence. So this is 2,000 pages footnote to this statement. And I want to stress the hypothesis. I'm not saying something was in such a way. I'm just saying the sources at our disposition give the impression that it may have been like that. That's important for me. This is what we had earlier, and this is also for what I'm going to present next now. And from the discourses, I also went into the Vinaya. So there's one volume with collected studies on the Vinaya. And then there's the story of how the order of nuns came into being. And women in Buddhism is one of my specializations beside meditation. And it took me 10 years to understand that story. How, based on studying and translating all the different versions in the different Vinayas, this basic story of how the order of nuns was founded. And what particularly was my interest was an attempt to understand two things. I mean, we cannot say with any certainty what happened in ancient India, but we can reconstruct the evolution of texts. and texts have their own story, and this particular, these two elements are very influential in modern, even up to modern tradition. We were early talking with the other monks about the revival of bhikkhuni ordination. And a considerable part of the problem is based on this impression that the text gives that the Buddha simply refused to start an order of nuns, and when he was somehow tricked into it, then he said, wow, this is the death knell for Buddhism. And so in doing this comparative studies, I mean, others have before said, this is like very strange, we can't believe it, it doesn't fit with other discourses, what they say about the Buddha. But with the comparative study, we can actually try to understand how these ideas came into being. And so the refusal, we can see that in several of the parallels, this refusal comes with an alternative option. So there is this Mahapajapati Gotami, she comes and says, I would like to become a nun, and the Buddha says, no, but you can wear robes, you can shave your head, but for the time being, stay at home. And this suddenly makes a lot of sense, because at that time, to the best of our knowledge, Buddhism was just in the beginning. They didn't have monasteries. In ancient India, for women to be out on the roads was very dangerous, particularly if they are part of the Shramana tradition, which was sometimes seen just very easily available. Any male can just grab you if they want. And so it was really important to be careful and to find a way of negotiating this coming into being of an order of nuns with the actual situation at that time. And the interesting thing is that even in those versions where we do not have this second part, this information, you can do it in such and such a way, Mahapajapati, nevertheless, she does put on robes and she does cut her hair off. And if we look at those other versions, it looks just very strange. The Buddha says no, and then she does that as if she's openly, like, kind of revolting against him. But with this piece, the whole narrative in the different versions suddenly makes sense. And the whole refusal gets a kind of context. The other one, the prediction of a decline, according to what I was able to find, it seems to have started with the first Sangiti, the textual account of the first Sangiti. This is a meeting of the monastics after the Buddha had passed away. And so it is quite possible that when the charismatic leader is no longer there, that those who have maybe more fundamentalist or misogynistic tendencies really saw this order of nuns as a problem. Because in the ancient Indian context, that was not something so usual for women to be at the same position as men. And so they had this feeling of decline, and this is being voiced in the Sangiti, and then from the Sangiti, where it's a discussion between Kassapa and Ananda, it migrated to the foundation account, where it's a discussion between Buddha and Ananda. So this is how I think this prediction of decline came into being. Anyhow, I must say that because of the time, I'm just really throwing out very short ideas, and I would really recommend also for the next books I'm talking about that all of these books can be downloaded from the internet to read, because it's much more complex than the simple presentation I'm giving here. Another topic that I got to is the Abhidharma, the beginnings of the Abhidharma. And there's a standard idea in scholarship so far that, and I'm debating that, there's this idea that basically the Abhidharma thought is predominantly seen as a result of formal aspects, of either summaries and lists or question and answers. And this never really made so much sense to me, because we have summaries and lists in all kinds of traditions outside of Buddhism, and question and answers in themselves don't really give cannot be really the source for the dynamic new model of thought that emerges with Abhidharma. And so by looking at certain discourse, and we see like this much is common, but here's something different and it seems new and brings in a new idea, we can see the beginnings of Abhidharma thoughts in some early discourses. And so this is the conclusion I came. Basic shift in perspective in early Buddhist thought. If you ask me how to get to the exit, I would just say you go out here, turn left, and there you are. But now, no, there's a room in which are 85 different chairs, so and so many pictures, so and so many people, and this kind of curtain, and you go out of the door and you get this whole detailed description trying to present a complete map, and that map mirrors the belief in the Buddha's omniscience. In early Buddhist thought, the Buddha was not yet considered omniscient. That is only a later development. Another thing I looked at was the beginning of the Bodhisattva idea. And I published two books on that topic. And yeah, there were several ideas that are central for the Bodhisattva ideal that I believe we can trace to the early discourse, to certain notions and certain contexts that come about. How am I doing on time? Yeah, I'm not going into that because I want to leave time for question and answers. So just what is Vinaya, Abhidharma, and the beginning of Mahayana, if you like, can together say there's this basic conclusion I have. So what I'm saying is there might be differences with some of the details of my reconstruction, but I think this one stands. And my overall research conclusion really is that it is time for us to allow early Buddhism to have its full place in the study of Buddhism. And there is somewhat of a circularity. There is this idea, I cannot know anything about early Buddhism. When I have that idea, of course, I also don't study it because it's meaningless. I can't know anything. And because I don't study it, of course, I don't know about it. So there's a circularity in there. And with that circularity, then Anario comes and studies it and comes up with all these results. And I'm saying, like, where does he get that from? How can he be so sure? But actually, I think this is solid evidence that can be used for hypothesis, for constructing informed hypothesis. And if in the 19th century there has been an obsession with origins, I believe in the 20th century there has come, as a natural reaction of that, eventually an obsession with ignoring of origins. And what I would like to say is, let us leave aside both obsessions and let early Buddhism have its part, not be the only one, but not also be excluded in the study of, in the academic study of Buddhism. And I think this conclusion stands even because I published so much, people have hardly gotten a chance to criticize my errors. I might have made errors here and there, but I think this one stands. This one can no longer be disputed. And besides doing this foray into Vinaya, Abhidharma, and Mahayana, because of my meditation practice, I of course also continue to research on meditation. So there's one book with collected studies on meditation, then a book on compassion and emptiness, another book on how to deal with disease and death. You could tell earlier that this is one of my favorite topics, and a meditator's life of the Buddha, where I go through the life of the Buddha only from the view of his meditation practice and try to relate that to meditation. And of course, I also continued to do work on Satipatthana, my PhD, and then perspectives on Satipatthana, trying to look at the Chinese parallels, and now the recent Satipatthana meditation practice guide just on the practice, on how to practice all four Satipatthanas. And in a way, this is really what it all boils down to the practice of meditation, to mindfulness. In fact, what I have been presenting here, it's not so much about, oh, Anario is such a clever one, it's really about the power of mindfulness. The power of using meditation and meditative qualities to do academic work. And my success is really because I practice, in particular mindfulness. And the mindfulness practice is being recognized on the clinical settings, and I hope that it will be also increasingly recognized for its potential in the academic setting. And so by way of conclusion, I'd just like to give a little bit of a practical example. Excuse me. How to work with certain meditative ideas in an academic setting. As this discourse in Samyutta Nikaya, this Brahmin Sanghara, where he comes to the Buddha and says, Bhante, sometimes I memorize and I forget it. This Vedic reciters. And sometimes I don't memorize and I still remember it. How come? And the Buddha says, because of the five hindrances. And that discourse really struck me. I thought that this is interesting. So we have these five hindrances: sensual desire, anger, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. I try to implement them to my actual academic work. Now, sensual desire, for us monastics, excuse me, but it's a little bit easier because we don't have a relationship and all the time and energy that goes into relationship dynamics, we can just forget about that. We live a simple life, take one meal, and that's it. But anger is a real problem, has been a real problem for me. So the fact is, the need to recognize. So you're there, an email comes, and stop. And now you don't reply. Wait. Wait until the anger has calmed, then reply. This simple method has saved me so much trouble and so much angry responses. Because if I write a response from an angry mind, I am unable to see things in perspective. I'm not balanced. And obviously the other person is going to hit back. A very simple method. Sloth and torpor. Mindfully keeping an eye on the condition of our mind. When I am clear, like after I've meditated, email off, SMS off, door closed, do my research. When I'm anyway tired, then it's time for email, if you like to do texting or whatever, just to be clear when the mind is awake and not tired, to use it for the creative type of work and to keep watching what is the condition of the mind and not allow us to, well, I wrote to so-and-so, let me just quickly check if they replied. That is not useful. That is not useful because we keep getting here a texting, there an email. The mind is so tired. At the time you want to work, you can't do the work anymore. Restlessness and worry. For us as academics, the main thing of restlessness is, of course, the so-called deadlines. Somebody asks you to write something and they say, okay, you write on that topic, until then you should finish. So a very simple trick I do is I just put them forward. If you give me a deadline, I put it 3 months earlier. By having that deadline 3 months earlier, I don't get things right that 3 months, but maybe 2 months earlier, I have my things finished. And I can put them aside. And by the time it comes to hand in things, I have finished my stuff, I've let it set, I can just read through one time, send it out, no problems. And I know so many of my colleagues, they wait until the last minute, then they're struggling to get it ready, they send it off, they stop. No, I still have to add something. If we just have that little trick and see that, look, if I'm putting myself in a condition of restlessness and worry, my mind is not going to work well. Let me avoid that. Let me just play this trick on myself. And the last thing is about doubt. I only write when I have clarity of the mind. I don't just start, oh, let me write about this, and then look a little bit here, look a bit there. I research, I collect all the information, I note it all down, but I wait until all the findings I have formed itself into a complete picture in my mind. And when I have that complete picture, then it's time to write. And I usually write in one flow of the article, flip, bitten, check the references, show to friends, and out. Because that clarity is there. And so, as the final conclusion, thank you very much.
So I've already got a new book idea for Venerable Nalio, The Dharma of Productivity. now this is the question and answer portion of the night. And
I'm surprised anyone's staying, that people aren't running off to write a book.
Three books. 10 books. We've got people running around with microphones, yeah? Well, I don't need one. Oh, I'm doing the live question and answers, actually, so I do need one. So... So maybe I'll start with a question from the online audience. Why faith? Is faith around? So we have a question from Nicholas, and he asks, does the boy's chanting point towards any known tradition or lineage?
And this is what I tried to say. It is, as Charles rightly said, it is very clearly a Theravada collection of Pali texts, but it does not fit any of the editions we know.
Okay, do we have a question from the audience here? Chris.
The mic, where's the mic?
My question is, I guess one about an epistemology of precision. I was intrigued by kind of your reflection on the text that you felt were sort of lacking certain precision in certain ways, some of the earlier, I believe some of the earlier articles. And I guess it's something I've questioned within myself is, how do I come to understand what I understand when I'm trying to understand like a text or something? And given that the dimensions of practice are so important in my view to understanding context and experience, while also understanding intellectually and understanding kind of how texts perhaps have originated and then evolved and so on, how do you then see that precision that you need in order to do the translation, the work of articulating things that kind of balance both ends of that? And what do you think was responsible for imprecision, if you will, in some of that work?
Well, it was just that the scope of my research was too broad. It's a very simple thing. It was not really so much in the epistemological kind of direction. It's just if, like Charles is here, I mean, he's done this wonderful study on one Sanskrit fragment of the Dirgha Agama. And it's just such a beautiful PhD he's done. And he really goes and he reconstructs the Sanskrit. He shows the different Chinese version. That is the kind of work where you can have a lot of detail. But the work that I do, if I take 152 discourses and compare them with their 300 or 400 parallels, I just can't have that type of precision. This is all I was saying. I can have like what my advantage over Charles is a little bit that I can have a clear idea of the type of material we are dealing with. So what I think I say in the introduction to my habilitation is that I'm fishing with a big meshed net. A lot of the small fishes are escaping me, but what I bring home in the net makes this effort worthwhile. Do you want to?
I would just want to add that Venerable Inalio's saying, though, that the studies on the Majjhima Nikaya are lacking in precision doesn't do justice to what he does. I would say that the photograph of the Earth that was taken from outer space and showed us what our planet looks like, that picture is lacking in precision. But it shows us something very, very important that we wouldn't be able to see otherwise. And it changed everything about how we see the planet that we're on. Just say that the studies on the comparative studies of the Majjhima Nikaya and the Chinese Agamas really are monuments of scholarship. People had thought that no one can try to do this because it's too big a job to do. But having the sense of the whole is a way of encouraging people to start to do things with this precision. And if we didn't have that, no one would kind of see the real significance of why we really need to have this done. And the falsehood that, oh, you can't study early Buddhism would just be perpetuated over and over.
Do we have another question from the audience here?
Thank you for being here with us. I was hoping you could elaborate more upon the consequences and the possibilities of the non, the Vedic memorization without knowing the meaning, or the translation, or however it's articulated, and not that it's distinguished by the absence of that kind of understanding, but possibly what are the possibilities? So what is it doing instead?
I have to ask you to help me because I did not fully understand your question. If you could say a few more things, maybe I get an idea of what you're asking about.
I'm thinking about the idea of memorization and recitation.
Yeah.
And the possibilities of that having a function that doesn't have to be necessarily the meaning, if I was...
I get you now. Yeah, we have to keep in mind that in ancient India, they didn't have any writing material. They didn't use writing for sacred texts. So the only way of passing on a text through history is by oral recitation. So the whole idea of needing to memorize with precision is to maintain a sacred body of text for later generations. And that was the main purpose. And those Vedic reciters, once in their youth, they had learned this precise memorization. Afterwards, they did study the meaning. It's not that they were for their whole life ignorant. It's just that the transmission of the Vedas has achieved an incredible degree of precision over many, many centuries of oral transmission. And because of that research on this Microsoft Word thing, I finally understood why and why the Buddhists were not as good as them. And that was my finding. Why, for example, in Buddhist texts we have all kind of, well, tricks is not a good word, but all kind of tools they use to help memorize. They say the same thing three times. They don't say, it is good, this is good, nice, and I like it. Or they have this repetition kind of thing. Then when they have several words, they call it the principle of waxing syllables. You start with a short word, and then a longer one, and then a longer one. All these are aids to help people to memorize the text because they did not have that precision of the Vedic reciters. And this explains why texts, even though to all apparent means they were trying to pass on the text, why there can be so much change. And that was my puzzlement. I found sometimes comparing the paths, they were so similar. And to small details. And then there are suddenly real major differences. And strange differences, the same text but in different sequence. It makes no sense to conceptualize this as intentional, somebody doing it on intention. But it makes also no sense to conceptualize it as something trying to memorize with precision, unless I understand the limitations of memory and the limitations of the early Buddhist oral tradition. Thank you for asking that.
So I'm interested in your teachings on Anapanasati, and you've done so much work on the Satipatthana Sutta. Have you written extensively about your teaching on Anapanasati, and if so, where might one find that writing?
Coming out next year. The whole book on mindfulness of breathing is such an amazing practice.
Yeah, I'm a little bit familiar with the tetrads and your teachings, but I'm
so
very
book,
interested in
learning
more. The
book is in the process of being written, and next year it will come out with Windhorse.
Wonderful, that's great news.
And there will also be guided instructions, as for the last Satipatthana, that can be downloaded.
Thank you.
Maybe.
So we have an online question. This question is about the continuation of consciousness. Since we experience episodes of being unconscious, how can we be sure that consciousness persists?
I'm not really sure how I would want to answer this. The line of the questioning is that looking for evidence, raising something, how can we be sure about this or that? And almost always those kinds of questions will, I think, kind of fall short. They won't be convincing. So what you could say is that the questions about the continuity of consciousness are arising as answers to other kinds of questions. And that what you want to do when taking up the answers is to see them in connection to the kinds of questions that people were asking. And what Venerable Anaglio has done is to show, oh, those questions were changing historically, and that there's a difference in the way that consciousness was thought about in early Buddhism and the way that it began to be spoken about in the commentarial periods and later, that the momentariness was a different way of answering. Mm-hmm. And it may have been even a different kind of question on this. So the idea that, there's different answers to the same phenomenon. I think Venerable Anaglio has said, no, it's not really, that's not precise enough. That we have to say, oh, there's a different question here. And then there'll be different answers about consciousness that happen.
Thank you. Yeah, from an early Buddhist viewpoint, I would simply add that unconsciousness is not conceptualized as the absence of consciousness. In fact, the absence of consciousness is death. It's a definition of death.
Do we have a... Yes. One of you.
Okay. Hi. Thank you. So you earlier talked about mindfulness, so I was thinking... I can talk. So I was thinking about the meditation part. So there's in meditation, like you get to a point, you see the nimittas, you see the glorious things, and then you're like super like happy, and then you're just like bam, the next sitting meditation. And it's kind of applicable to like ego in general on a daily life. It's like the moment you're like super happy, the next like you kind of get a reality hit, and then you're like super down. So it just keeps on going up and down and up and down. So I can also see this in my meditation. And so when I try to be mindful, it's not mindful, it's more like a roller coaster ride. So, like, do you have any recommendations on what I should be doing or how to fix it?
Well, I don't resonate with your experience very much because I think it could be because of giving too much emphasis to this whole idea of having a lightning meter. Mm-hmm. And in order to get deeper concentration, but that is not really mindfulness practice. It
yeah.
has mindfulness as a component, but real mindfulness practice is simply to be with things as they are without reactivity. And that is something that builds up momentum, it builds up momentum, and you don't get this up and down. So my personal suggestion would be if you could try to give less emphasis to the cultivation of concentration, and more emphasis to just mindfulness, to being with things as they are. And then carry that also from formal meditation into everyday life. And as you carry mindfulness in everyday life and use it creatively in different situations, you will find that it improves your ability, your productivity, your ability to deal with people and with things. And that then gives you the real motivation to practice rather than the reaching out for a particular experience to be getting through this limiter and the not getting off the experience then being a failure and the whole progress being conceptualized with the view of the meditator who reaches out for appropriate meditative experiences as the tools for the construction of the identity of a meditator. If you can look at these points, I think you might find a different experience.
Thank you. Can I ask a follow-up question? So you talk about mindfulness, but how do you maintain that mindfulness? Because when I try to maintain that mindfulness, like other things pop in and I usually like get super ecstatic when it happens that I usually get off. So it's like it's constantly a push and pull and push and pull trying to go back to the mindfulness.
Yeah.
But
so what I suggest first of all is in the way I teach meditation is to use whole body awareness as a support. This is Kaya Katasati. And an embodied form of mindfulness is a key that runs through all of my meditation instructions. And even in this situation of the two of us talking to each other and looking at each other, we can be aware of our body and have some awareness of the body. And the second thing is that I conceptualize the practice of mindfulness not with this idea of I should be mindful all the time and then I'm failing that standard because that creates frustration, but much rather I conceptualize mindfulness as a good friend with whom I like to come back as often as possible. And that gives a completely different perspective. And I also use the fact that Sati in Pali is female to see it as a female friend. And she is my female friend to whom I like to come back as much as possible and be with her. But whenever I miss out on it, it's not something that I hit myself on the head and you missed it, you should be all the time mindful, but just, oh, I missed it, but here she is, and I come back.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. My question is also related to meditation practice itself. So I think I have this assumption that there's many kinds of techniques for meditation, and I, as a beginning meditator, I'm looking for the technique that resonate with my my character, my resonate with me. So if I tried some meditation that, for example, visualization related technique, I don't felt resonating with it, then I move on to try different ones. And is this a right approach? Is it, should I think about different way that even if I don't resonate with certain technique, I should still keep on doing it? And then that comes, like, at what point do I know this is the method I should continue, or should I try a different type?
Yeah, this is a question you have to some extent answer yourself. And it is through mindfulness practice that you will learn to answer it to yourself. You will see sometimes that there's something that you feel like it doesn't resonate, and mindfulness tells you, yes, indeed, you don't resonate, leave it. But at other times you may find that I feel it doesn't resonate, but if I look really deeply, I find actually it's just that I'm not really putting in enough time to try it out. And when you check with mindfulness what the practice does to you, and you also get feedback from others, from your husband, your children, your parents, your work environment, and they say like, hey, you're meditating, you're as angry as we were all the time before, then you know there's something wrong. If they say like, wow, you're really changing, what's happening to you? Then you know something's going right.
So we have a similar question from an online listener. This is someone early in their practice, and they're especially interested in early Buddhism. And so they're asking, do you recommend trying to stick with those early Buddhist texts and practices? And is it a problem to explore other traditions at the same time?
Well, I don't, and you see, I really don't want my research on early Buddhism to become sort of like early Buddhist fundamentalism. This is the only right and everything else is wrong. So how could I say for somebody else what they should do? I am simply, this is one part that I resonate with, as my mindfulness has taught me and is telling her, and this works for me. But I put it out in a spirit of open source, and everybody has to take their own responsibility and decide what resonates with them. And if it's Tibetan visualization, then that's wonderful. That's so powerful practices. If it is Chan meditation, working with the Korean Son tradition, working with the Huato, wonderful, beautiful. I mean, there cannot be one right thing. The only really one right thing is to keep looking inside what things do to us, and that is mindfulness.
So I think we can do one more question from the audience here.
Well, two quick ones, but feel free to answer only one. If you could speak maybe about how your own practice has evolved over those 3 or 4 decades that you've been practicing. I find in my own case, I've been at it now for a dozen years, that there's a tendency to for the practice to go stale if I don't take care of, if I don't try to stay at the edge. And the second question about the commentaries and their relationship to early Buddhists, like the Visuddhimagga, if you care to say anything about that.
Well, you know, the commentaries are 1.5 millennia closer to early Buddhism than we are, but they're at the same time 1 millennia away from it. So there's this in Sri Lanka, commentaries are the authority. And in the West, it's like commentaries chuck them out. And I think both are a little bit unbalanced. I find a lot of beauty in the commentaries, but I really like to look and see the early suttas not through the lens of the commentaries, but see them in their own right. And so it is the same vision that I also have for the different Buddhist tradition. I have this interview we did at BC Beth with Evan on respecting the different Buddhist traditions. It's up at YouTube. And what I'm trying to say that there is not one right thing. They're simply different formulations of the Dharma. And here in the West, we get these different manifestations, and we can all allow them to stay side by side based on that historical perspective. And so it's not that momentariness is wrong. I need to think in terms of momentariness if I work with the Burmese Sayadaw, who comes from the commentary tradition. Otherwise, I won't understand what this wonderful teacher is offering me. But when I try to understand early Buddhist meditation, then I have to set aside the idea of momentariness, because that is not there in early Buddhism, and so the teachings are not based on that concept. And so in this way, I can hold the Burmese style, the Tibetan Rinpoche, and the early Buddhism. I can just allow them to be there on this continuum and try to learn from each based on that clear understanding of the historical background they have. And then with that variety of things, I can also see, like, okay, my practice is becoming stale. Why don't I do something that makes it interesting again? Is it really the case that I have to find one single meditation method and stick to that for the rest of my life? Is that really meaningful? Or is it not just that I can find different entry doors to the cultivation of mindfulness? And when I find the practice is becoming stale, that's an alarm signal. Mindfulness is telling me there's something you need to do. Bring in variety. Try to find some way to get things moving again. Do some different practice. Look at different practices, different traditions. With that flexibility, and that flexibility itself is mindfulness. It's mindfulness that tells us stale. Mindfulness tells us this works, this doesn't work. And this is what we have often in the suttas, even according to the suttas at the time when the Buddha passed away. How can you become self-reliant, an island to yourself, by relying on the Dhamma, taking the Dhamma as your island and refuge? By satipatthana, by mindfulness practice. This is what tells us, no need to ask somebody else, what should I do, is this right, is this wrong? Checking with mindfulness, and we know ourselves, we become our own masters. So, again, it all boils down to mindfulness. And we can conclude with that.
Thank you very much. Bhante, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and a privilege to have you join us tonight. And Professor Palasi, thank you. We're so fortunate to have you join us.
It was wonderful to have you with me.
And everyone, thank you so much for coming. Till next time, thank you.